Did the crime as part of a group of three or more persons who all actively participated in the crime. End quote. And three Colorado cops have resigned after video surfaced of their arrest of a 73-year-old white woman last June who was slammed to the ground and handcuffed. Karen Garner, who suffers from dementia, suffered a dislocated shoulder, a fractured arm, and a sprained wrist. Another widely circulated video shows cops laughing while watching footage of Garner's violent arrest. Garner has filed a federal lawsuit, citing violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 73 degrees and overcast. In New York City, 63 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
You know, it's one of the best unions we have in the whole West Coast, I guess, you know, or even the whole world. Nah, I won't go that far, but, you know.
Mayday. May 1st is Workers' Day around the world.
We have always had a lot of repression against labor and against social movements, particularly the black movement.
1 year into the pandemic, workers are facing growing challenges.
We will end racism and we will eventually overturn capitalism. Yeah!
Today, we hear from working people from across the globe. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches people's lives. I'm your host, Tia Coatley, also known as Tia Marie, a Pacifica affiliate, WXOX 97.1 FM, Louisville, Kentucky. Dedicate this program to healthcare worker and ER technician Brianna Taylor, who was murdered last year in her home by Louisville police. First, thousands of trade unionists and supporters of May Day rallied in San Francisco. It included all Bay Area labor councils, and it was led by author, scholar, and activist Angela Davis and Trent Willis, president of the International Longshore Workers Union, ILWU Local 10. Here are their voices.
And sisters, today, if you look out over the bay, you'll see the silhouettes of container cranes. They call that CHE, container handling equipment. You see this all over the Port of Oakland, some in San Francisco. Well, none of it is moving today. None of it is moving today. Because back in 2005, the membership of the ILWU Local 10 decided that we need to put more focus on May Day, the real Labor Day. Yes. Now, for those of you who don't know what May Day is about, in 1886, we had some strong brothers and sisters that stood up similarly like you're doing today, but it was a much rougher fight. Some of them lost their lives. They lost their lives so that you and I can enjoy good working conditions, so that you and I can enjoy respect from the corporate bosses instead of tyranny. It was a fight for the eight-hour day, because before that, the employers in this country used to work poor people to death, literally to death. In some places, it's still happening currently today. We need to stop that. Another thing we need to stop is systemic racism. The reason we need to stop systemic racism, because systemic racism has been in the way of the labor movement since the labor movement's inception, which the labor movement started when black people were brought over here as slaves.
That's right.
That was the labor movement back then also.
Let's go.
And when you stand up for the labor movement, You're standing against slavery. You're standing against systemic racism. And most of all, you're standing against systemic oppression. Now, systemic racism is a part of systemic oppression. Since we stood up for the master, for the cooks in the 30s, we knew this. We knew it was wrong to oppress the LGBTQ community in the 30s.
That's right.
And we still have the same stance. We want to end systemic racism, okay? Because like today, the port is shut down. And it's shut down by white, red, yellow, black, and brown. Because we understand how to put it down. An injury to one is an injury to all. Free Mumia Abdul-Jabbar. Sister Angela Davis.
You know, let me say that we have to protect the right to organize. Pass the Poll Act. We have to protect the right to organize. And we have to stand up with our sisters and brothers who are behind walls, our sisters, our brothers, our gender non-conforming comrades. And as Eddie pointed out, abolish the prison industrial complex. And we want to be able to look forward to a world in which the repression of police, the racism of police, is no longer necessary. As a matter of fact, I think we want to abolish the police as well. I think we want new ways of imagining safety and security. We want housing. We want schools. We want jobs. We want free health care for all. And we say no more George Floyds. No more Breonna Taylor.
No more.
No more Dante Wright.
No more.
No more Oscar Grant.
No more.
No more Stephon Clark.
No more.
No more Sean Monterosa.
No
more Sean Monterosa. And we also say, Labor United will never be defeated.
Those were the voices of Trent Willis, president of the International Longshore Workers Union, ILWU Local 10, and author, scholar, and activist Angela Davis. Now, more voices from the May Day rally in San Francisco.
It's May Day. Represent the local. My name is Lolita. I'm Lolita Roberts. I'm a B member here. ILW means to me is strength. Strength in numbers. An injury to one is an injury to all.
Empower the working class?
Power of the working class. Right on.
My name is Imani Trias. I'm a B member with IWU. 10-18-65 is a plug. And it's my first time with the May Day, and learning a lot.
The IWU is going to be leading the march here in San Francisco on May Day. You think there's a reason for that?
I think there's a reason because of the history. We were the original leaders of this march, and then so we're trying to repeat with the history. Bring back May Day and lead it again today.
My name is Junior. Okay. I'm here representing the ILWU workforce. I'm just grateful to be with this union. You know, it's one of the best unions we have in the whole West Coast, I guess, you know, or even the whole world. Nah, I won't go that far, but, you know.
You're here on May Day.
I'm here on May Day.
1967, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King spoke here at this hall, and he said he was not a stranger. He felt like he was very much a part of the ILWU because of the support that Local 10 had given him and the SCLC during the Civil Rights Movement.
This is when the FBI and the government were trying to crush him and spying on him.
You know, some less than 7 months later, he was dead. He was assassinated. But he came here. And one of the things that he talked about was how the civil rights activists learned about the sit-ins from the sit-down strike in 1937 with the UAW workers in Flint, Michigan. And he talked about the same people who opposed the civil rights movement are the forces that oppose the labor movement.
Bankers too. Let's get up and learn those rules. When the man and the crazy chief, one said sun and one said sea. AM, the FM, the PM too. Turning out that boogaloo. Get you up and I guess you out. But how long can you keep it up? Give me Honda, give me Sonic. So cheap and real phony. Hong Kong dollar, Indian cent, English pounds and Eskimo pence.
In 1992, labor historian Howard Zinn gave a talk on the hidden history of the U.S. working class. Here's a part of that talk.
I had experiences in my life which made me begin to question what I had read in history books about war, about class conflict, about the race question. So it became clear to me the more I read, and history I read on my own, that philosophies that caused people to think that there is a class system in the United States. There is a reality of class from the very beginning of American history. And it was only years later that I learned, you know, who worked on that railroad? Who died working on that railroad? The thousands of Chinese laborers and Irish laborers who worked on that railroad, who worked themselves to death, who were worked to death on that railroad, who worked long, long hours in bitter, bitter cold, who got sick and who died, and who were just thrown away ruthlessly by the railroads, and more immigrants brought in to work on the railroads. That was behind the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. And nothing in the books about who worked in those steel mills and under what conditions they worked and how many died working in those steel mills. Those are very dangerous jobs, working in steel mills, working in foundries, working on the railroads. At the time that J.P. Morgan announced the consolidation of railroads in the United States, he was a great consolidator. 2,000 people were dying every year in accidents on the railroad. Industrial accidents in this country have exceeded deaths in war. But you don't see that as part of the story. In the year 1914, 1 year, 35,000 people were killed on the job. And hundreds of thousands injured on the job. There's a human toll of injury and suffering and pain, of lost limbs, of lost fingers, of lost legs, of people crushed in industrial work. That's part of the cost of this great economic progress that we've been through. And the point of this is not simply to correct the historical record, although not simply to, as Morrison suggested, just tell the facts as they are. But the importance of this is that it's all suggestive about something today. It's suggestive about the fact that we have to look twice, three times at progress, at what is called progress, at technological progress, at going to the moon, at building spaceships, at anything that's presented as, well, this is a wonderful thing because it's advancing science or nuclear reactors, nuclear energy, and so on. It's wonderful, wonderful things. Chemicals, plastics. How lucky we are to have plastics, you know. How did people live before there were plastics? I mean, these are the issues that are raised by a reconsideration of industrial progress and human cost in the 19th century are really the same issues, you know, that exist today when you consider the economy. The economy has to be seen in class terms. They do not want us to see the United States in class terms. Exxon and us. We have a common interest. I mean, that's what patriotism is, the creation of a common interest, the artificial creation of a common interest. And so the language that suffuses politics is devoid of class content. So they talk about taxation, they talk about spending, without any notion, without any suggestion that there's a class element to this. And so they'll talk about, well, the liberals want to tax and spend. Then the liberals get excited. Liberals are very excitable people and sensitive people. And say, no, we're not for taxing any more than you are. We're not for spending any more than you are. We're not for peace any more than you are. We're not for anything any more than you are, except winning the election, which we are for more than you are, you see. But I haven't seen any candidate, anybody running, saying taxation is a class issue. Yes, let's tax. Let's not be afraid to say, talk about taxation. Yes, we need to tax. Not the poor, not the middle class. Tax the rich, tax the super rich, tax the corporations, you know. The corporations in the United States pay an average tax of 15%. Some of them pay 5%. Some of them pay 0%. In Japan, they tax the corporations 40%. They started from the very beginning of this country giving welfare to the rich, to the bankers, to the merchants, with tariffs, with partnerships and banking between the United States and the National Bank, with subsidies. It was a subsidy here in San Francisco given to the maritime industry, which is one of the causes of indignation among the maritime workers here, and led to the great San Francisco strike of 1934 and the general strike of 1934 in San Francisco, as these the marine workers, the sailors, the longshoremen, the dock workers became aware of the conditions they were living under and the fact that the government was giving money to the industry. And had been for some time. So to look upon these things in class terms, look upon taxation, spending, the welfare state. If you talk about taxation in class terms and talk about spending in class terms and say what you're going to spend for and say you're going to spend to take care of people, you're going to spend, take that money that we are getting out of taxing the super rich and the corporations and take the money that is being spent for these absurd weapons, hundreds of billions of dollars for that, then we could spend the money to have a free healthcare system for everybody and free housing for everybody who needs it, and no problem of food for anybody who needs food, no problem of the basic necessities of life for people who need them, no problem of guaranteeing jobs for people who need work, no problem of daycare in families where daycare is needed, none of that. So I'm suggesting that the hidden history of class of labor and capital, if you don't mind me using words like that, you see. But the hidden history of that in this country, the history that George Bush and all of his club members, you know, want to obliterate, is exactly the kind of history, you know, which we should reconstruct and remember and bring forward. Thanks.
That was labor historian Howard Zinn speaking in 1992.
A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion, sex, and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. At the top, they are telling you still. First you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill, a working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I am Tia Coatley, a.k.a. Tia Marie, from Pacifica affiliate WXOX 97.1 FM, Louisville, Kentucky. Now here's Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer speaking with Vermont AFL-CIO President David Van Dusen about the issues working people face on May Day 2021.
This last election, your council, your state federation, as well as councils in Southwest Wisconsin, Rochester, the MLK, were very concerned about the danger of a insurrection of a fascist coup. Why don't you talk about your concerns about the rise of fascist movements and what that means for the labor movement?
Well, our concerns were well-founded. January 6th was an insurrection. People died. There was violence in the streets and a takeover of the Capitol building. We teetered on the brink of losing those vestiges of democracy that we have today. That was a dangerous time, and that time is not over. Let's not think that the far right from the Republican Party and neo-fascists have packed it in. They're still there, and they're still organizing. So fascism is not just on the rise, but it is spite. These are serious dangers, but here's how we beat it. Two ways. Direct confrontation. In my belief, you can never allow the fascists to have the streets. You can never allow them to control the public discourse. I believe that fascists must be directly confronted, just as our grandfathers did in World War II. We have to do this here at home, if that's what it takes. But also, we beat it through social justice unionism. The labor movement has to do, the responsibility we have to history, is to create not just a strong movement to protect the more narrow self-interests of our members. We have to do that. But we have to go beyond that into social justice unionism, whereby the labor movement acts as the force fighting for the common good of all working people. And if we can create a truly independent, strong, mobilized pole within the political spectrum, one that is independent from the Democratic Party, one that is independent from the more mainstream capitalist forces in the United States, then naturally working people are going to be attracted to that. And you know who is the great majority of people in this country and in every country? It is working people. But we need to be shown to be standing up, taking risks and challenges, and doing what needs to be done to stand up for the working people if we're going to expect other working people to rally to our cause.
You raised this issue of the general strike, you and these other councils. What was the response of the national AFL-CIO?
It wasn't just 11 of us on the executive board making that motion. We passed an authorization at our convention. The delegates did. 87% of our delegates, after an hour-long debate, authorized us to call for a general strike in the event of a fascist coup in this country. It was the right thing to do. We make zero apologies. That was absolutely what we should have been doing everywhere in this country during those dark, dangerous times. National AFL-CIO seems to see it a little differently, Steve. About a month ago, we got a letter from Richard Trumka, national president of AFL-CIO, announcing that he was going to start an investigation against us for misconduct as a result of daring to have that vote. Think about that. Our republic faced an end to democracy. We took the very modest step of having our rank and file democratically vote to empower us to call for a general strike in the event of a coup. And the response of Richard Trumka is to launch a retaliatory investigation against the 10,000 member Vermont AFL-CIO for misconduct. Let that sink in. Over the last week, we've had half a dozen of our officers contacted by the national AFL-CIO with a request to conduct investigation interviews. So we are aiming not to be distracted by this. We have serious work to do here in Vermont, trying to build support for a Green New Deal, mobilizing for a mass May Day rally in support of all workers in our state. We have so much work to do. We have organizing campaigns going on. And the last thing we want to do is be distracted by this kind of retaliatory action from Washington, D.C. But it is ironic that as we sought to defend our own democracy, God forbid union people in the AFL-CIO dare to exercise democracy of their own. So I think that that's a statement not just about the state of a republic and how precious and precarious the democracy we have may be, but also a statement about the lack of internal democracy within the labor movement itself, specifically within the AFL-CIO. But look, that doesn't mean we turn our back on the AFL-CIO. We are committed and we believe that this is a vehicle for change. So we've been reaching out to locals all across the country right now, central labor councils, different state federations, to talk about building a united, that's our caucus here in Vermont, but something like a united progressive caucus within the national AFL-CIO, so that when we have an election in a year from now, we can elect a slate of folks that share our commitment to building true union democracy within the AFL, to committing ourselves to social justice unionism, and to making those connections within communities that are necessary to build real power, and to take some tens of millions of dollars out of handing it over to the Democratic Party, which has let us down, and putting it into our various organizing departments to help us grow our numbers as organized labor.
And the pandemic hopefully is in decline in the United States. We don't know. And it's exposed the serious failures of the structure of this system, privatized healthcare, privatized a system of deregulation. When the pandemic goes away, and hopefully it will, the same structure is still here that has made the rich richer, the very richer, and basically pauperized working people. Millions of working people have lost their jobs and face a dire situation, even if the pandemic declines.
You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree with you more. And again, the lessons to be learned of the pandemic is the weakness of our social system in this country and others. If we would have had a rational healthcare system with universal coverage, we would have been so much better positioned, not just during the darkest hours of the pandemic, but for the distribution of the vaccines. We could be further along today. If we had paid family medical leave, if we had adequate mandated paid sick leave for everybody, we would not have had to scramble during the pandemic to try to claw those things into various workplaces. And mind you, we're still fighting within cities, within employers, within unions to maintain those things, hopefully now that we're on the back end of the COVID cliff. But we need a robust social system. It can't just be about having a political voice and having a good contract. It has to be bigger than that. Working people, who are the 99% of the people in this country, need to reap 99% of the benefits that the wealthiest country on earth creates. And we're not in that situation yet. And while we have learned that lesson, while working people, many of them have learned this lesson of the weakness of our system, the need for change, it's clear as day to me that huge aspects of both the Republican Democratic parties have not learned those lessons. Thus, we don't even have all the Democrats backing the PRO Act in Washington, D.C. Here in Vermont, they've tinkered around the edges. The Democratic Party, which is massively the biggest party in the state, with the Republicans and the Progressive Party being smaller, they refuse to advance basic things like car check for public sector workers. It's absolutely incredible. They say it's not a COVID issue, right, is one of the things they say. But the fact is, during COVID, we would get calls on a weekly basis from non-unionized workers who were being forced to work without PPE in unsafe working conditions, piled into trucks, worried about dying or bringing a disease back to their families. And they did not have a rapid and fair means to unionize. They were scared to go through the VLRB, our labor board process for recognition, public sector workers, because of the retaliation that they expected from the boss and the intern. So if we would have had card check then, dozens of workplaces right here in Vermont would have been unionized right now as a result of the pandemic. And I guarantee you, thousands of times over, that has played itself out across the United States and millions of times over around the world since this time last year.
So we're coming up on May Day. You are confident, you're optimistic that things are changing in the labor movement, that that the working class is going to become revitalized and build a organization, a movement that can organize everyone in the United States.
Absolutely. I'm absolutely optimistic. I mean, here in Vermont, for example, on May Day, we're going to be marching side by side with groups like Migrant Justice, 350 Vermont, the Unite Electrical Workers, VSCA, DSA, a true cross-section of the people of this state. And we are not interested in anything less than real solidarity on our different issues. And specifically, we're going to be calling for not only the passage of the PRO Act, but things like car check that potentially could help us build our power here in Vermont. But I am absolutely optimistic. I know we're going to turn that corner. And I'm looking forward to building that national progressive caucus that will change the national AFL-CIO from within.
That was Vermont AFL-CIO President David Van Dusen speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. New York CWA Cablevision techs recently went on strike for a union and produced this rap song about their struggle for justice on the job. Unfortunately, their union efforts were defeated and the strike was broken.
That did all the work to make him rich, rich, rich. And he's certainly not making you rich.
It makes sense to add sex. 2 years you've been absent. Looking for a contract. Instead, you give us nonsense. Make me nauseous. Playing corporate offense. Lawyers in my face can't stand union busting. Hustling, grinding, wondering what's next. JD in the straight shot to my vein pumping. American dream. There's no access. Feeling like a fiend. Overflowing pockets. Eating all the profits. Labor, suffering. Jobs overseas while the state stays jobless. I see all the action. Rich kids, tax cuts. All faith in him. In the end, it's gotten trust.
That's right.
Now, more voices from the May Day rally in San Francisco.
The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed the underbelly of capitalism. Because people are in the streets, because people are shutting down ports like we did in the case of Juneteenth last year, 2020, and as we're doing today on May Day 2021, the port is shut down. ILWU Local 10, once again in the vanguard, leading the way.
My name is Jose Carlos. I am from the American Postal Workers Union Local 2 in San Francisco. So we are here to join the big celebration of the May Day, a big historic day, very important for the labor movement, and we need to do more things for the labor movement to keep all the benefits and, you know, trying to gain more money for us.
And what do postal workers face? You're under attack. They tried to shut down?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, especially in San Francisco, they're planning to closing down the ISC facility. That's the airport. So the union is trying to get it together so to stop that closure.
May Day means that this is the workers' day. The workers are standing up for what we've always done, and that is fight for justice. That is fighting for 8-hour pay. That's fighting for our rights. Democracy. So we're fighting for our jobs. We're from Oakland, UCSF Children's Hospital.
What happened in Chile? Many things are happening in Chile today because we are in the middle of this pandemic situation. So the government is doing really no good for the workers, and our situation is critical in Chile right now. Many workers are in a strike right now. So we are here because we are trying to save them, and we are with them.
The economy of of Argentina faces a growing threat of bankruptcy and is yet again virtually under control of the International Monetary Fund. Argentine Workers Party leader Guillermo Kane reports on the struggles of working people and unions in this contest.
In Argentina today, there's a very complicated situation because we have coming together a prolonged recession over almost 3 years. We have a very strong foreign debt crisis, which, of course, is a structural feature of Argentine economics and society. The strength of the dollar over the local currencies and perpetual capital flight from Argentina as fixed features of our economy over the decades, which have led to a strong process of deindustrialization, of the strengthening of foreign capital, which compromises about 80% of the ownership of the companies that function in Argentina. This situation has come together with the impact of the pandemic. There's no food, there's no work, there are no vaccines. What we're trying to explain is that without income, quarantine doesn't work. So we need measures to really be able to apply quarantine, because without that, basically it's a demand on the state, because it's showing that it's not taking the necessary measures for quarantine to work in Argentina, which include, of course, vaccination. Now, apart from some of the strikes that are going on, which have to do on the one hand with wages and on the other hand with sanitary problems, we have important teachers' strikes these weeks against classes which don't have conditions for them. We have health workers' strikes. We've had factory strikes. For example, Bridgestone, which is one of the large tire companies, which is a national industrial union, which is headed by the PO, the SUTNA. And there were 6 cases of COVID there last week. And we went for a full strike of the factory because the U.S. Japanese owners of Bridgestone were against isolation of the workers who had been in contact with those 6 COVID cases. So we shut down the factory and went into a general strike to impose. And there is also a political campaign, which in this case, the Partido Obrero has been able to win the rest of the left front over to, which we think is politically very relevant, which has to do with vaccination. We put out 10 demands, 10 points in general on the health situation, which start with the centralization of all private and public health system under control of the workers and other points. But we've also, and there's a very particular point, which is the government says we can't get vaccines. The international market is very tied up. You know, the bigger countries or the more powerful countries, the imperialist powers, have controlled all the available vaccines. But actually, in our country, AstraZeneca has a laboratory that's producing the vaccines. But the owners of this lab, which include an Argentine businessman who's very closely connected to the government, the Ministry of Health, has people who used to be his employees in all the main places. And Mexican billionaire Carlos Slim, who is in business with him, what they've done is the agreement supposedly is for those vaccines produced in Argentina to be then packaged, filtered and packaged in Mexico. And they were supposed to be used for Latin America, but they never came back. Last report on the millions of doses that left Argentina for the Mexican plant run by Slim said that doses were then sent to U.S. And it's not clear if its final destination was U.S. Some say it then went to Australia. But there's a situation where AstraZeneca is not complying with the contract it had signed with the state. For example, a similar situation happened with Italy. Italy seized a shipment that was in its harbors because AstraZeneca had not complied with its contracts. So what we are calling for a public campaign is that the state has to seize this lab, all the doses that are there, which supposedly they say they can't package them in Argentina, which is a lie because there exists the industrial capacity to finish these vaccines and package them exists, and to be able to use them for the situation in Argentina and, of course, the neighboring countries. Brazil has become one of the international centers for the health crisis, and there are new variants. There's a second new variant in Brazil these days, and in Chile and in Uruguay as well, the situation is very dire. So we think that a state-owned, workers-controlled, taking over those private labs who are speculating with their production instead of putting it in the hands of the population is very important. And we're doing a public campaign. We've done a rally at that lab's gates. This has been covered by the national media. We're getting signatures in a street campaign across the country, obviously in difficult conditions because of the increase of cases itself.
That was Argentine Workers Party leader Guillermo Kane.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops and the smiles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving amidst the wonders we have made. But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old. For the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
We just heard Rochester labor musician Matt Seidel. Under President Jair Bolsonaro, Brazilian workers are facing catastrophic consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic. Fabio Bosco, a Sao Paulo transit worker and member of the independent trade union federation, Conlutas, talks about the pandemic and the government's responsibility.
Today, the situation is very bad. The hospitals are overwhelmed. In the majority of the states, you have no UCI beds available for the people. But still, the public healthcare system in Brazil, which used to be powerful, you see, but 30 years of underinvestment make it weaker. Even so, it has a presence all over the country, and we are counting on these public services in order to help the people, to save the people that are infected. Up to now, 135 people died in the line to get a UCI bed. Here in São Paulo, which is the richest part of the country, the pandemic is bringing an economic crisis, but together with it, there is inflation of the most basic foodstuff that people need to eat, like rice, like beans, coffee. The prices are much higher than they used to be last year. So it's a very complicated, I would say dramatic situation. And I feel that sometime, sooner or later, we are going to have sacking in supermarkets, you see, because the poor people, they are desperately in need of food. The idea of Bolsonaro, I think there are two main ideas, you see. One is to bring back the dictatorship to Brazil. And the second one is to privatize everything that is possible to privatize. What's the problem? There is a lot of resistance among the people against the dictatorship. The polls show that only 15% of the people would support some kind of dictatorship here in Brazil. And privatizations are not popular these days. So there are difficulties. What they do it slowly. They privatize sections, parts oil wells, but to privatize the whole oil company, for instance, it's still a big debate here in Brazil. We have always had a lot of repression against labor and against social movements, particularly the black movement. I don't know if American people are aware, but here in Brazil, there is a genocide of the black young people. Something around 60,000 people are killed every year in Brazil. It's really a genocide. What's happening now is that big business wants to have all cards on their hands. 2 weeks ago, it started an uprising in Paraguay, which is a neighboring country here. And the people went to the streets because there is no hospitals, there is no vaccines. You see, it's the same situation as we have in Brazil. So what the big business, what they are afraid is that a social movement may emerge and get out of control. And who can control it? Bolsonaro, what he would do? He would put the military in the streets. Then Brazil would become a new Myanmar. So the other card is Lula, you see, because Lula is something like the Democrats. He has a lot of support among labor leaders, you see, reformist left, the reformist leadership of social movements. So he's in better position to deal with any social explosion. And so what happened? The Supreme Court canceled the sentences against Lula. And now Lula can run. Look what Lula did. His first speech after his sentence was canceled was to call a national unity front with the mainstream bourgeois parties in order to offer a solution, a way out of Brazilian crisis, you see? It would be something like a left-wing party in the U.S. to call the Democrats and part of the Republicans to make a unity to find a solution and later to run in the elections with one candidate. So what I can tell you, this is an illusion. It's true that the people, the working people are angry against Bolsonaro. They are afraid as well, but they are angry. And there is a possibly we are going to have an anti-Bolsonaro wave in the elections next year. And Lula, what he wants to do, to put him together with the bourgeoisie to go over this wave and be elected president or vice president. But what we see is that labor and the social movements will not benefit from a government of this type. It's the same experience we had for 13 years. 13 years. So we believe that we should work in another direction, you see, to build an alternative of the working class, that we should go in this direction and not mess with the mainstream bourgeois parties. So we are standing for a national lockdown. We are standing for an emergency allowance to the poor and the unemployed, support for the small business. We are also standing for waiving patent rights so that we can accelerate the producing of vaccines here in Brazil and nationalize all private hospitals and put all this healthcare system and the production of vaccines under workers' control. That's our demands. But we feel that to get any of these demands, we have to fight to put down Bolsonaro and his deputy, Mourão. So we combine these necessities for the working class to survive the pandemic with the struggle against the one that is the main responsible for the situation the working class have been living in Brazil.
That was Brazilian labor activist Fabio Bosco. Now, more voices from the May Day rally in San Francisco.
I'm Ramona. We're here in support of workers today on May Day and education workers in particular.
What union do you member of?
I'm with the UCAFT. We are the lecturers and librarians at UC. City College people, and I'm just happy to president.
The regents? UC management?
Yeah, what about them?
What are they doing?
They're stonewalling us and making the lecturers go through bargaining for 2 years. No job security whatsoever. They won't pass anything across the table. They're totally unreasonable.
Is that union busting?
Absolutely. Of course it is. Oh, my gosh.
Who do they represent? It's a public institution.
The regents? That's a good question. Who do the regents represent? I don't know. Themselves. I don't know.
Hi, my name is Charles Minster, a retired trade unionist here to support the struggle of workers around the world and to put forward other ideas of revolution. It's been over almost 150 years since the founding of May Day, and we still do not have a workers' party in this country. And right now the labor bureaucrats are deeply in the pockets of the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party is right now the mainstay of capitalism in this country. So we need a political party that represents the workers' interest, and the workers' interest is to take power in its name. Capitalism can no longer meet the needs of society, and it must be replaced.
My name is Roger Marenko, President, Transport Workers Union Local 258 here in the city and county of San Francisco.
And why are you here on May Day? What's May Day mean to you?
The reason I'm here for May Day is because May Day represents unions. May Day represents workers. May Day represents the labor movement, meaning everything from fair wages, living wages, good health care, benefits, etc. That's the reason I'm out here, supporting the labor movement.
And this has been a terrible thing, this COVID. How has it affected your members? How many members have you lost?
We've lost many members, way too many. One is always way too many members. Our service levels have dropped tremendously. The public transportation is at risk of actually failing in terms of its downward spiral that it's currently facing, but we are doing anything and everything possible to bring back public transportation in a safe, reliable manner as soon as possible.
You think it's time for a labor party?
Say it again?
You think it's time for a labor party?
This is a labor party. That's why we're out here.
All right, my name is Gerald. I'm a member of the Oscar Grant Committee Against Police Brutality and also the Labor Action Committee to Free Mumia. We have, as the Labor Action Committee to Free Mumia, has been working with the longshoremen for decades, consistently supported Mumia Abdul-Jamal.
And you're marching with the ILWU today.
That is correct. We're marching right behind them.
Bill Claus is a volunteer producer at KKFI Community Radio in Kansas City, Missouri. He is a labor activist who has collaborated with labor artists. He was a close friend and associate of the great labor songwriter, singer, Ann Feeney. He offers this tribute to Miss Feeney.
In my book, the latest chapter in women's history ended on February the 3rd, 2021, with the death of Ann Feeney at age 69 from COVID-19 pneumonia. Ann Feeney was a dedicated activist, singer-songwriter, recording artist, storyteller, humorist, union maid, and a self-described hellraiser who sang the songs Walk the Walk, Talk the Talk on picket lines at rallies and demonstrations. And like she said in her song, she has been to jail for justice just like Cesar Chavez, Dorothy Day, and Martin Luther King before her. From the stage, Ann liked to joke that she was a recovering lawyer, but even as a lawyer, she fought the good fight with immigrants, refugees, and domestic violence survivors as her clients. For the years, she marched, demonstrated, rallied, and sang against the Vietnam War. She co-founded the Pittsburgh Rape Crisis Center and fought against apartheid. But mostly, she sang in support of workers' rights and union solidarity. She covered Woody Guthrie's Union Maid, Joe Hill's Preacher and the Slave, and put Sojourner Truth, Ain't I a Woman, to song. But Ann was also a great songwriter with such songs as War of the Workers and Have You Been to Jail for Justice. Ann came to Kansas City a number of times over the years, appearing at such places as the Carpenters Hall, then on 39th Street at IBEW, even doing a fundraiser for one 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Ann Feeney, fighter for justice, union maid, and hellraiser, always getting in good trouble.
Listen up.
We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. In solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. When they boost your copay,
war on.
That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We heard music by The Clash, Mike Seidel, John Lennon, and Ann Feeney. We thank producers from Pacifica's five sister stations and more than 200 affiliate stations who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Steve Zeltzer, Polina Vasiliev, and Ann Garrison. Our executive producers are Akua Holtz, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I'm Tia Coatley, a.k.a. your favorite girl, Tia Marie. Thanks for listening.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The COVID-19 crisis continues to ravage India, the world's second most populous nation, which now accounts for one in every three new cases reported worldwide. On Saturday, India counted more than 400,000 daily infections for the first time, while a record 3,700 deaths were counted yesterday. The New York Times reports that 12 patients in a southwestern province died from lack of oxygen yesterday. The Associated Press reports that the New Delhi High Court would start punishing government officials for failing to deliver oxygen. Health workers are rushing to ramp up inoculations in India. So far, fewer than 2% of India's 1.4 billion people have been fully vaccinated. The head of the Serum Institute of India, the world's biggest vaccine manufacturer, warns that shortages will persist for months because the government of Narendra Modi failed to prepare for a massive second wave of infections. The White House said it will start barring entry for travelers who have been in India within the previous 14 days. The United States has lost the opportunity to achieve herd immunity to coronavirus, at least in the foreseeable future, according to a New York Times survey of scientists and public health experts. Those experts say the increasing spread of contagious variants means an ever higher fraction of the population must be vaccinated to reach herd immunity, but vaccination rates are declining in many states. The spread of variants could have been prevented if enough people had been quickly vaccinated, but hesitancy, largely along partisan lines, prevented this. Experts still point to widespread vaccination as the best way to control the severity of coronavirus outbreaks, which will likely remain a fixture of American life for years. Rather than ending the pandemic entirely, the focus of these experts is now on controlling the virus to mitigate hospitalizations and deaths. Please get vaccinated. A total 105 million U.S. residents have been fully inoculated, and an additional almost 42 million are partially inoculated. But growth in total vaccinations has slowed. The average daily number of vaccines administered in the United States has dropped over 26% from its peak of 3.3 million a few weeks ago. Racial disparities in vaccination rates are persistent, with almost one in every three white people at least partially inoculated, compared to roughly one in five black and Hispanic people, according to the CDC. Daily vaccinations in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia have declined over the last week, while the rate in New York State stopped its rapid decline to rest at around 172,000 doses administered each day. Restaurants, offices, stores, parks, and many other businesses in New York State will reopen at full capacity on May 19th, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced today. New York City will return to 24-hour subway service on May 17th. Cuomo's announcement comes a week after New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio said the city would fully reopen by July 1st. Although the state is lifting capacity restrictions, businesses will still have to